All right, thanks for coming to our session here. I want to once again encourage people to come forward since we have exactly one slide. I'm going to go ahead and put that slide up now and just leave that up for the remainder of the presentation. We're not all proud of what we've done to get to where we are. So we originally had four people on this panel, and one of those was Rachel Rubin, and unfortunately she couldn't be here with us, but for probably the best of reasons, she got promoted yet again and got a nice new job as an AVP of Marketing Communications. So good for her, bad for us. We're going to go ahead and do a panel without her. And this is going to be a pretty free-flowing session today. We're going to mostly just have a conversation, hopefully not just up here. Hopefully you guys will have questions as well. We also have Patrick Burt from University of Central Florida in the corner here, who is monitoring Twitter. So if you are interested in asking a question and you, for whatever reason, don't feel like raising your hand, you could lazily tweet at, you know, the session and he'll get the question to us, all right? So we had a couple of questions that we had posed among ourselves when we submitted the talk. One of them, we were talking this morning, and actually one of the questions was, how do you convince your boss you deserve to get paid more? So do you guys have any tips on that?
Let's see. I guess from a director's perspective, doing good work, number one. So completing tasks, of course, and really talking about, you know, kind of working through the entire process, not just like doing something because, you know, it's what you, comes up in your head, actually doing some research, you know, asking some people things, and actually being open to having discussions about anything that you're actually working on, and then talk about those discussions so that people see that you're not just a someone who can, I don't know, so that you're including people who you don't necessarily even or have connection to a project or anything like that. Really showing that type of effort, I think, goes a long way.
I think for me, one of the things that I guess I and probably a lot of us here sort of have a chip on our shoulder from the days of being called the webmaster or the web guy and this like generalist that can do everything, that those days just aren't really around anymore. And I think that, you know, it also is part of our responsibility to show that we are experts, we are professionals. There's lots and lots of specialization now that each and every one of us has. I mean, is there any, and I don't mean to like sound negative, but is there anybody here, how many webmaster title people are there here? Actually, more than I thought. Yeah. You know, I think more and more, though, as a trend, that's going to stop happening as much. And it's not like it's a bad thing by saying it, but I think that I have never been a webmaster in my life, and I just think it's, you know, we need to be advocates for ourselves as much as, you know, anything else.
Real quick, how many people, show of hands, how many are actually directors or managers of a web group or department now? Wow, awesome.
It's like 80%.
Yeah. How many of you are aspiring to be into that position, hoping that you're going to get that director
management?
Okay.
And yeah. How many of you just want to understand what the hell your director's thinking? Okay. All right, pretty good mix of everything.
Well, hopefully we can give you some insight into the insanity that is the people who have agreed to run a web department. One of the things I always struggle with is managing managing people is something that Carlin Morissette said it really well in her session right before lunch, that most people get promoted into a management job not because they are great managers, but because they're good at what they do, they're experts, they're subject matter experts, and they get promoted, and now they're expected to be managers, and there are a whole bunch of really terrible managers. So it's something I've worked really hard on, is learning how to manage people. But managing creatives and managing developers, geeks, divas, whatever you want to call them, is one of the biggest challenges I've had. What are some tips or some stories you guys have had around managing those types?
I'll jump in. So, Sorry.
No.
Okay. So I'm in a little bit different position than Chaz and Nick. They were both developers before they started. I was a front-end person before I started being a director. So we had this like long conversation this morning about how they have a really hard time working with designers. Well, not a hard time. Sorry if like one of your guys' employees is here, I feel bad now. But like they have, it's a challenge for them to wrap their heads around that mindset. Whereas for me, it's the same thing like with developers. As much as I would love to, you know development, I really don't. And so I have to train myself to learn and think in their shoes.
I don't know, I guess one of the things that the way I got to where I am is kind of interesting because I started out in the department as a student and then a full-time employee and then the director. So everyone that I guess I manage, I worked with like on a day-to-day basis beforehand. And so it's kind of difficult to go from that, you know, colleague relationship to that, you know, boss relationship. And so luckily, I've had the time to develop an idea of everybody's working habits. And that was probably the best thing that that happened to me because, you know, if you come into a position fresh with new employees, especially creatives or developers, you cannot treat them all the same. Everyone works completely differently. You know, there are different hours of the day, different types of coffee that each one drinks to really make sure that, you know, they can get in the zone, they can actually do work. And so I guess for me it was taking the time to see everyone as an individual and make sure that they had the tools that they need to get their work done in an effective way, whether that be in the 9 to 5 or if they're working at home at 8 p.m., you know, to 2 a.m. to get work done, if that works for them, then so be it. And for me, I guess it's just building those relationships and trusting the employees that they know that they need to get stuff done, but you need to also give back and give them some leeway.
Yeah, I really struggled with that until I realized that not everybody is like me. Everybody has their own different things that drive them and motivate them. From a work standpoint, I know my developers love doing fun projects, something that's challenging, something that's different. So, you know, we give them projects. We did our campus map thing, and that was a challenge because they're learning a lot of stuff they'd never had to do before, and trying to work with a Google API that changed mid-project, and all of those things. And that was fun. It's challenging, but it was fun for them. And then I've got designers that care about making things look amazing. And they will do everything they can to make it look amazing. And the most demotivating thing for them is getting in their way and telling them, you know, we can't do that, the client doesn't want to, or we can't do that, that's too different. And that's soul-crushing for some of the designers. And not everybody's ambitious. You know, some of my designers and developers want to continue doing what they do and do great work. And I, on the other hand, wanted to, you know, manage our team. And that's not something that everybody has aspirations to do. So I realizing that not everybody is in the same mindset as I was, and everybody has your individual aspirations and motivations, was critical to learning how to manage them better.
That was one of the things for me is like when I started, you know, I'd just been like a doer, and I've had lots and lots of bosses, lots and lots of really bad bosses. So I had a good precedent of what not to be as a director. I knew exactly what not to do because I'd had a lot of horrible bosses before. And I think one of the things for me though is I started to realize that, like, I'm a perfectionist and really anal retentive person, and sometimes I was the bottleneck, I was the problem, and stepping out of the, like, getting out of the way and I hired people because they're more talented than I am at what I hired them to do, and I got in the middle and in the way, I think.
What's the number one thing you learned from a previous boss of not to do? What's the best lesson you learned as to a behavior not to emulate?
I have mine.
Go for it.
Okay. I had this boss who, like, every single day, there was like an early morning, I guess it was like the drop by, and she would stop by at like 11 in the morning and be like, "So Matt, what you doing?" And like, you don't know how to react to that. It's like, do you like just want to like socially chit chat, or like do you want like a list of what I'm doing? And it kind of reminds me of The Office, like when the Charles guy is like, "Hey Jim, give me a rundown." You know, like what's I don't know. How do I react to that? And to me, it would happen more than once a day, and it's just like, you know, let me do my work and don't put these like awkward, because we weren't like socially like engaged, and so it was this like fake thing that I think was really trying to see whether or not I was doing work. And we had this session a while ago with my team, and we all sat down over beers and just kind of kicked around everything we did in the last year. And I asked that all of us brought together any personal issues we had with each other and just be blunt, including with me. And no one said anything bad about me, and I thought it was weird. So I started like probing, and I was like, okay, does it annoy you guys that I like spend a lot of time in the office and like stop by and like interject myself and stuff? Because I hated that my last boss did it. And I guess it was the fact that I actually know what the hell they do that I can add to that conversation. So,
yeah, for me, it was a boss that built a really great team dynamic, and we liked working for him, and we had a great time, and we were all very good friends, and there was this real strong cohesive team. And then I realized, like toward the end of his tenure, and after the fact, long after the fact, that he built that team dynamic by giving us a common enemy. It was the IT department on campus, and so. It was always the IT department's fault. They were the bad guys. They were the ones getting in the way of us doing greatness, you know, achieving greatness. And after the fact, I realized that like all of our relationships were so badly damaged because he set this evil IT organization up, and then everything that would go wrong, we could always point to them. Well, that made it easy at the time, but it also caused us to not get stuff done because you have to work with the IT department sometimes. And we actually have off-site servers that we host ourselves, completely separate from the university, because of those kinds of that bad relationship. And it's something that we could have avoided. It was probably saved a ton of money and probably managed a lot better. Also, none of my guys are sysadmins. None of my guys want to be in that business. They want to be great developers and designers. And now they're forced to do stuff as a result of a decision, you know, he had. I don't know if it was conscious or not, but you know, the evil IT, you know, empire. It's not how it works. So, yeah. Right, this guy's part of them, though, by the way.
The Borg will assimilate you. So we keep going. Do any of you guys have any questions so far? Like, yeah.
So the question is, where is content in all of this? She's a web director, and she has. You have content on your team, or you're the content person? Okay, web. Okay, great. And so you have it sounds like you have a good sized team. You have social media and strategy. And do you guys have content people on your team, and how does that fit in? How do you work with that?
Well, okay, so we used to have a content person, and then now we no longer do. And so we actually have to rely on, we have one content administrator who kind of like oversees how content is being published. And then we train each of the schools and colleges and departments who are actually publishing their web content how to write for the web and how to, you know, effective ways to get users' attention without being, you know, blinking tags and stuff like that. But, you know, from my standpoint, we don't write a lot of in-house content that isn't already kind of not provided, but that already comes from press releases or, you know, marketing material that we just kind of reshape to the web. So we don't do a lot of original writing. Is that part of your department, original writing for the web? As for what, like the homepage or your everything? So you guys produce? Okay.
We had an epiphany last year where we realized that every single project takes twice as long as it should. And what could be probably done if we didn't have clients in the room in like a week and a half really stretches out to almost a year long for just a department site. And I see people shaking their or nodding their heads, so you guys know what I'm talking about. The problem was the content. Like, we can design, we can build templates. We can't put stuff in the middle for you about your content. We need your expertise to get that in there. However, the people who are writing that content are not content people. They're not writers. They're not web people. Usually they're faculty or they're admins or they're somebody whose job it is not to produce content but to do something else. So producing content for their websites always felt lower priority. And with if we had somebody to produce content for these sites, even just to work with the clients, we would get these things done so much faster. So we just hired, we just had our first copywriter full-time start. And the goal is to have him on every project, go and interview, and at least help fill in the big chunks of the sites. Because the content was so bad when we would get it, and they would be mad because it can't be, you know, bright pink Times New Roman, and I don't understand why they needed to format it in the first place. We're not talking the same language. The end result is we have to make an effective website. It has to communicate, do what it's supposed to do, but I can't rely on a non-expert to be able to do that well. And so we need to have an expert on our end to at least help facilitate it. My hope is that that's going to smooth that whole process over a lot. I might be optimistic.
So. Yeah, at every job I've had previously on any website that I was a part of, I never got engaged in the content of the site, and it was a really bad thing. It's really bad to just be like the web guy and be like, I just care that it functions and it looks good and all that, but like I don't care what it says, and I think it's a really bad thing. And I had this, I guess, my own epiphany recently, and it's like my very top hiring priority is to get a copy editor, because I think that in any site that we do, I mean, I think it's the biggest problem with websites on campus is the copy. I mean, design is design, and you know, it might suck, but people are there to get information is the number one reason people are on a website. You know, they're not there to react to the aesthetics of it. They're there to get something. And like when we did our new university website, we had atrocious copy. It was horrible. And so I went to my writers, and like we have writers in our division, but not on my staff. And I talked to them, and I talked to like the head of that team, and I said, you know, like they're really, really talented at what they do, but they don't know web copywriting. And so I kind of sat down with her and I said, you know, I think I'm going to kind of bring in a freelancer to do this. And so I worked with the freelancer. They worked with the freelancer as well. And when the project, when we launched, they said, I am so glad you did that, Matt, because we learned so much by reading what this writer wrote. And so they've been able to learn from it. But still, like, I think I really need someone that's on my team. You know, like, the writers have the news and press stuff. They do the magazine. They do all that. But I think it's one of the biggest positions that I'm missing on my team right now.
Yeah, I used the analogy when we were trying to make the case for hiring this thing it was like giving people a nice, pretty, wrapped box with a bow on it and a really great wrapping paper, and it was structurally sound, and it validates too, but there's nothing inside the box. And that's like the worst present you could possibly get is, hey, how great this is, and then there's nothing there. And that's what we're getting people, are giving our clients, is a pretty box that's solid, but has no substance to it. And that was the content. And then eventually we brought in a vendor, and five of the six people they brought to the meeting were writers, were content people. And he asked them, so who works at your company? They were like 30 people. And almost all of the people who work there are responsible for content. They have a couple of designers, they have a couple of developers. Everybody else is content, because that's what people want. That's ultimately what they're providing. And that was what got our boss thinking, oh, really? You guys have content people? Yeah, go figure. So.
We had that conversation this morning, and it seems as though Chaz's... Oh, sorry. His question was, you have all these different people with different personalities, and you have to manage them all differently. What about people that are like a strict, you know, 9-to-5 employee versus these people that do these really kind of alternative, all-over-the-place schedules? And now I lost the track of my answer, so go ahead, and I'll come back and think of it.
I think the question was about how to manage without showing favoritism.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got different kinds of people and you don't want to... Yeah, we struggle a lot with, so my entire office, my policy is you can work from home basically whenever you want. Everybody comes in on Wednesdays for our staff meeting, and I have one-on-one meetings with my staff, and we do all those on Wednesdays blocked up, so I know people are going to be there. And then typically people are in, you know, throughout the week off and on, and they have different schedules, and they have different needs. One guy doesn't, you know, want to pay for childcare 3 days a week for 4 hours, so he works from home and kind of does that. Though anybody of small kids, you know how hard it is to work from home and have a small kid running around. I'm kind of skeptical that that's working for him. But, you know, ultimately, I believe that you start with saying, okay, I trust you to do what you need to do, and work from home, and it's a privilege.
Yeah.
But it's not one that you're going to have to earn over a long period of time with me. You know, I want to see that you do your work. But as soon as I see that you're not, it's something that we're going to dial back. And I've done that before as well, where it wasn't working out for somebody. I wasn't seeing things getting done. And I don't have to see them doing their work to know that it's getting done. I can approve and I can review the quality of their work after the fact just as well. But other departments on campus have a real problem with it. And they don't understand how this works. They're very skeptical that anything is getting done because they don't see it. If they come by or they call somebody's office and they're not in the office, they assume nothing's getting done. But listen, this is the web, and things happen. And we also have to be very quick to respond. When something happens, the homepage might need to get changed. Something breaks. Somebody's going to be on the phone to get fixed. So I know I can call any of those people at 11 o'clock at night and know that they're going to drop what they're doing, they're going to get this thing fixed. And I know a lot of the guys are working early in the mornings or late at night to cover for it. I completely respect the lifestyle that they want to have, and it's higher ed. I can't pay them what I'd like to pay them, so this is one way I can.
Do
you have
your HR
blessing to be doing that?
Shh.
Yeah. I know when we talked about it this morning, like, his team is much more informal about that. We have kind of like there's no like you check in allocation of days, but like everybody on our team every once in a while works from home, and we definitely not as much as his. Like we try and keep it to maybe like once, you know, every 2 weeks or something. Like, again, we're not writing it down, we're not checking it. It's like if someone maybe does a couple more this 1 month, whatever, and we just keep kind of, you know, we're all adults. Like, you know, you can take care of your stuff, and in the end, all I give a shit about is that the work is done. I don't care necessarily, you know, when we're doing it. We did, after a little while, we realized that we're starting to grow, like, more and more, and as we get bigger and bigger, when we have people on really alternative schedules, we decided to kind of have what we call our core hours, where we at least want, like, a solid overlap of a certain chunk of the day so that, you know, like, we don't have some people coming in at, like, 7, some people coming in at, like, you know, 11-ish, and then some people staying till really, really late, and then really in the end, with lunch thrown in there, you get maybe, like, a 4-hour overlap, a 3-hour overlap, and it's just hard to be productive, you know, doing that, I guess.
We're doing the same thing. I'm free.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it happened to me at my last job. I was the guy that worked, like, I worked in a more, like, print office, and I was the guy that was never at the office. I was, like, a million times more productive when I wasn't in the office. My boss knew and acknowledged that I was a million times more productive when I was not in the office, and I even had the conversation with her. She goes, "Oh, Matt, I can tell you're getting shit done." And I'm like, "So what's the problem here?" "Well, you know, the office assistant is just getting really jealous," and I'm like, "Okay, fine, I'm back, whatever." You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's just a thing you have to deal with. Again, if someone's really uncomfortable with it, you know, I guess you got to change it up.
Yeah, I guess it really depends on, like, the team. If it's somebody internally, like, hopefully you have employees who talk to each other and who can communicate and, like, be civil with each other and say, okay, you know, this person is getting X, Y, and Z privileges, and this is why. And so if you want something different sure, we can work something out, but if it's beyond like the department, so say it is like the dean's office or something, who's like, why is this person getting special treatment and my employees can't do this and that, that's an issue that either, if you can keep
mind
it,
your own business.
Yeah, if you can kind of keep it on the down low, that might be better, if you know, because really who may speak up. I think you can probably tell at your institution who's going to have a problem with like flex schedules. But if it really becomes an issue, then it just has to be talked about, and maybe the flexing just does not happen in a way that it was before.
To be fair, my vice president doesn't condone what we do for our staffing. I just as soon as she found out that one of my staff was working from home 3 days a week on average, 2.5 to 3 days a week, she flipped out and said, those people shouldn't be working from home more than 1 or 2 days at most. And the question was, well, why not? How does that affect their work? I mean, explain to me how it affects their work. And I'm not going to get drawn into that argument with my vice president. We just said, I can't believe that. Wow. And you say, okay, great. But I try to fly under the radar with some of these things because she's not managing my people. I am. And I'm responsible for their performance and their behavior. And she doesn't agree with my management style sometimes. But I think she's coming around to some of those things. But she also doesn't manage millennials. She's a vice president. She's very late in her career. And she's been managing people for a very long time. And I have 20-somethings that are fresh out of college and are learning how to work. And that's a completely different challenge than what she's used to. And her take is, listen, you don't have to motivate people. If they can't motivate themselves, fire them and hire people who can. Which is...
Wow, that's pretty blunt. You really cut to it there. Yeah. Don't hold back.
Well, it's naive. That is one way to look at it. And in certain industries, that can work just fine. And in higher ed, where you're limited with resources and time, you have to learn how to manage people with the motivations they have. So I hope I didn't just get fired.
Well, I turn 30 next month, and I don't think I'll ever be mature, so, I mean, yeah. Oh, yeah, we meant to do that the very first thing, actually. I'll go ahead and start. So, admittedly, these two guys are much further along and much more advanced, so I'm like the rising up the hill, and these guys are admittedly have much larger and more advanced teams. So again, it's just different perspectives on what it is right now. Right now it's myself, a designer, a developer, and a CMS lead, and that's it. And the thing is that's kind of weird about it is I have the largest university out of all of us up here, and they have teams more than double the size of mine, so it's kind of awkward, and it's been making me think a lot, because I already know that growth is what we need, but I think that what I'm working on right now is proposals that pretty much say, like, now that we've got down the core things of the campus, well, that wasn't even the question, I'm sorry, stepping back, my next step of growth is pretty much, like I said, the copy editor. My designer right now is more of like a user interface minimalist designer. I'm looking to augment him with like a more graphic oriented designer. Still really want another developer, and then some kind of a project traffic manager at the moment. But I have none of that. So again, I'm speaking out what I have, and these guys have got, they've done an amazing job with what I've, these guys are kind of like, the people, like, I have known these guys for a while, and I talk to them all the time whenever I get to a point where I'm like, okay, I need to hire new people. How'd you guys do it? Because they've done all sort of the heavy lifting, so, like, it sounds lame, but I'm kind of, like, aspiring to be there, and I think they've done a great job on it, so I guess they can give their perspective of, like, kind of being there, yeah. So to speak.
I guess, real quick, like Wayne State University, where I come from, is it's got 33,000 students, and so we are web communications, part of marketing, and we don't have a presidential mandate for anyone to come through us. So we actually started 6 years ago as only a two-person team, a designer and a writer, and then we eventually got a developer, but only to manage the homepage and like admission sites. And so over those 6 years, we've kind of grown to start taking on other sites at the university, just kind of by influence. And so we don't have a mandate, so we have to just kind of show off that we are doing the right thing for our students and things like that. So now we have, we've redesigned in the past 6 years over 400 sites at the institution and kind of brought them all into one identity manual and one kind of server environment, CMS. So now we have myself, a web content administrator, 3 developers, 2 designers, and a multimedia person, and some student minions. But that's kind of, it's taken 6 years to get there, and now I think that we actually work like a mini agency within the university, which is kind of unique because we do charge each department for our services, and that not to make money, but just to keep our staff. And I think that's kind of the case with Chaz too.
Yeah, that's our model. Matt, you don't charge in your department, right? Right now, at least?
I will be shortly.
You will be shortly.
Part of the growth that we're probably going to be doing pretty quick is that we have people banging down the doors to work with us now, and we still have to do all of our core functions at the moment. So we're doing the growth so that, again, we can become a little bit more of a service-oriented group.
So our group at Notre Dame is actually called Agency ND. The website of it right now is what I manage. I have 9 people reporting to me. I have 4 developers. One of them is purely web support because, as we all know, every time you launch a new site, you're going to be maintaining it and helping them with that for a long time, whether you like it or not. And then I've got 3 other developers that do programming and front end and so on. I've got 2 designers. I have an information architect. Kate Russell presented yesterday on content tips you can take back for clients. And then I have a project manager and a traffic manager. And the traffic manager is about getting tasks from, you know, to the right person and scheduling, essentially. And the project manager is overseeing the flight of a project from start to finish. And he just started a few weeks ago. We have probably 40 to 60 concurrent projects at any given time in our group, not including the probably 150 minor projects or support tickets or whatever. That go on at any given time. So we also charge, and that's part of how we've been able to grow, is the university essentially said, you know what, everybody wants more money, everybody wants more people, and you guys actually charge for your work. So make more money and hire more people and pay for them. And so we've been put more in the direction of being a revenue-driven agency. It's kind of weird. You guys have Nick, you mentioned student minions. Do you want to speak to that
one? Yeah, we have 2 developer student minions and one kind of like content. He does a lot of content migration and things like that. And so they're just student assistants. They are either part of the developers are part of the computer science program and the content migrator, I forget what program he's part of, maybe I think a journalism. I think he's going for a journalism degree. And so actually
is it for pay or for credit?
They're for pay. And so actually within our department, they pay a little bit more than the other departments, which kind of, they use student assistants to like run letters back and forth between departments. So we're lucky enough to be able to incentivize them with actual a little bit more pay than other departments.
I have no student workers at the moment, but as far as the relationships part, you mentioned IT. That's a really, really, really sore subject with myself and my team. We kind of early in when I got, web had traditionally at my university been under IT. That the team that it was under is still technically there, and I was brought on to bring on a web team that would like actually do things well. So that team's still there. And I had like, I pretty much had it out with the CIO within short order of moving there because they told us they wanted us to use SharePoint as our CMS, and I told them to go, you know, whatever, jump off a bridge. And so that has set a very bad precedent, and I fault myself for that, and it's something that right now I'm really working to repair that relationship because I feel it's really, really, really important to whatever you're in, have that relationship. And right now I'm trying to bridge that gap by building good relationships with like the lower level managers and directors in IT. And when we're kind of making inroads, and I'll work my way up to repair that relationship. And it, you know, it's something with me, I'm a motivated person, and when I want to do something, I want to do it fast. And the CIO really thought that he could keep me under his thumb when I started because, like, I'm a young person. And that makes me madder than anything when people treat me like that. So, that's probably my worst departmental relationship, but it's something that I'm working on, so.
Yeah, I get. Yeah, well, so I was not in my position, but I was in the department when we started charging, and it was a little, I guess, well, our university traditionally was very decentralized. Everyone had their own servers. They could publish whatever they wanted at any time they wanted. If it was blue, pink, purple, it didn't matter. There was no oversight. And so, you know, looking, there also wasn't like full-time web people in each department. And so, you know, I guess if you already have a department in place that currently services other, you know, units on campus for free, it's kind of hard to say, this is what we're worth and we require you to pay us for that. One way that you can maybe start, I guess, that trend or at least that way of thinking is to actually create like invoices, but you know, have them no charge in the end. And so that from my standpoint, when departments see like, oh, we want, this is 2 weeks out from launch, but we want to add this feature and this feature, and we don't like how this looks, how much that really impacts, you know, the cost of a project, whether they're actually being billed or not. And so we always put together, we were actually billing, but you can, you know, put together, well, this is, you know, 15 hours of design and 10 hours of writing and, you know, 4 hours of programming to get this change done, that's an extra $1,500 for this change, just so you know. And for me, that has kind of gave us, or at least the work that we do, some value, that there's an actual tangible cost to it, even though it's all internal money and stuff like that. And I think even having it as an estimate, even though it's not charged, they see that dollar amount that goes along with each change request goes a long way, even if, you know, it doesn't hit their pocketbooks.
Just getting something done on the web can be done for very cheap, but getting something good done on the web is a very expensive and time-consuming process. Do you guys all know who M. Stoner is? It's a lot of nods. They're a great vendor. They're a great agency out there. They do fantastic higher ed work. They're very expensive, and rightfully so, because they do great work. And I don't think most people on campus realize just what goes into that work, just what comes out of it, what that cost is. So I'd like to, sometimes we try to draw a line between a project and the cost it would take to do this on the outside, because none of those people on campus can do that work themselves. You can't just hire your nephew to go and do a project like M. Stoner is doing, though a lot of them think they can. So if you can, you actually get them a bid from a company like M. Stoner or another agency and say, listen here, I want you to go talk to them, give them your requirements, and we're going to help you get an estimate for the work that you're talking about doing. When they see a very large price tag on the other end of it, they may say, you know what, that's not worth it for us, but hopefully they will look at it and say, wow, I don't have that kind of money, but I wish I did. And then you get to start to bridge that gap between, I don't want to pay for anything, and I don't want to pay for what you guys do, because you're probably going to be, as an on-campus entity who's starting to charge, considerably cheaper than M. Stoner. You may also not have the staff and the expertise and all of that that they do. I hope I'm not insulting anybody from M. Stoner. I really like them. But
I do too. I've recommended them to so many people,
yeah,
but like
too.
They are so expensive, you know.
But I use them as that example, is listen, if you want to do this kind of work and you don't want to work with us, that's absolutely fine. Here, let me put you in touch with them, and I'll send them to Patrick DeMichelle and M. Stoner, and he will talk to them. And usually after a five-minute conversation, they know whether they're in the game or not. And that usually helps move that conversation along. Not doing stuff. Seriously, the question is, how do you convince people outside your department that you need more help? And I mean, I assume you mean staff.
Yeah.
You need more people, right? My answer is, if it's not broken, it's not going to get fixed. And so the better you cover up problems and hide the cracks, the easier it is for the leadership who control the purse strings, who control the personnel, are going to be able to overlook the fact that you keep asking for more people. I need more people, but you're getting stuff done. And if you continue to get those things done through heroic efforts, then you're not going to get more people.
They assume that's just what you do.
Like, right, yeah.
Save
yeah.
the day.
Yeah,
the
so heroic efforts are not a sustainable resource. And leadership, they would understand that, but they don't understand that you're putting in heroic efforts. And they hear bitching and whining from everybody on campus asking for more people. So typically it's letting something fall down, something that's not going to get everybody in trouble or fired.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's the thing that I'm on the cusp of right now, is that growth thing. Like, we're to the point where we do enough stuff, and now everybody wants to work with us because we've done really, really well on the stuff that we've worked at. And my VP is really pushing me to, like, do this, take on that. And I said, the reason I've been able to do such good stuff is because we keep, like, our resources in check. And you realize we have very, very limited resources. And if you keep pushing on us like this, we're going to start to produce shitty stuff. And it depends on, like, what do you want, quality or quantity? And I think, again, like, These guys' teams across the board have produced really, really quality stuff because their universities have made the commitment to staff and to appreciate what they do. I mean,
we're down to about 2 minutes, so we're going to try to make the next few real quick fire question and answer.
Awesome question?
Any other great questions? The question is, you're a one-man shop, basically. You're a one-man department, and you're booked, and now you've been given additional responsibilities, which... you can only pour so much water into a cup before it's going to overflow. So the question I would put back to your boss or whoever is giving you this is to simply ask, okay, what would you like to take off my schedule? Because I can't add more to it without something else dropping. You may say nothing, but something will drop, and hopefully it's not something that you care about.
Yeah. And I think with the CMS part of it, I mean, if I'm going to be in charge, and this was the case, I was in charge of the CMS selection committee, and the CIO tried to push SharePoint on me, and with the support of my boss, I said, I'm in charge of this committee, so I didn't like wait what was selected, but I was the one that drove that because I'm the one who's gonna have to run and support that application. So like, you're not gonna tell me what tool I'm gonna use to do my job day in, day out. So that, I guess that for me was it.
All right, I think that's all the time we have for today. And I just got the thumbs up because she's been waving her arms saying, stop, stop. So thank you guys. Have a good rest of the conference.